Colin Passmore, Reel 3.
When my brother Barry came home and was demobbed, with his usual demob suit, of course, with saving material, none of the trousers had turnips. And he dearly wanted turnips, and explained to me how to do it. I thought, really, if he could have explained it, he could have done it. But with a bit of unpicking and pressing and refolding, I managed to get the effect that he wanted. And then, darn me, if he didn't pinch my knitted tie to go with his suit. It was a nice silk one, too. During the war, when my brothers were on leave, they would come to the local village hops with us, which comprised a piano and drums and a piano accordion, usually, if we were lucky to have that. And everyone greatly enjoyed themselves there. At times we did a lot of old-time dances, the Velita and the Lancers and going back. But that was once a week, so again it came going home. Even though somebody used to try and persuade one to sit and listen to the nightingale when it wasn't the nightingale's time to be out. And, you know, we went as a family, and, well, the boys and girls together. And, of course, the brothers had to get to know people all over again when they came back home. My brother Harry stayed in the Air Force for several years. I think he was demobbed in about... I believe he bought himself out of the forces. He'd had enough of it by that time in about 1949, 1950, because he wanted to get on with his life elsewhere. He didn't feel any future in it. The same with my brother-in-law. He was a regular soldier, but after the war, one thing and another, and a young family, he left the army as well, and they all came back into farming. I finished my schooling at the high school and did a stint of uncertificated teaching before I went to college at Chichester to complete my training. It was a 2-year course. And the college had been taken over for RAF purposes. I think the main hall had been adapted for an operations room, you know, the ones you see on television with people pressing, because it still had the upper gallery room looking with glass, looking down into the main hall. And I did my 2 years training then, which they considered was sufficient. And because of the grant that was allowed, I was supposed to be teaching in West Sussex, but then that was relaxed and you could teach elsewhere, and with the difficulty of travelling, you know, from remote country schools, I should have had to have had a push bike. That was relaxed, and I went up to Croydon to try a bit of town teaching and living in a town. And after a short while I married a farmer and came back onto the land again. So when the war started I was 13. And when it was finished, I considered myself quite grown up, quite a young woman. Coming out from college, I was 20. But when my brothers came home, Harry and Barry, they still persisted in teaching me, treating me as if I was 13 still. which greatly annoyed me, as I thought I was quite grown up and taking a job. But, you know, by that time all the family were grown and they began to go off in their different directions. I missed such a lot of meeting relations after the war because of my being away at college and then teaching. And because really it was quite an occasion to get together with your family. I can remember father having to go to a sheep fair in Dorset, and I went with him in the lorry so that I could meet relations down there, sort of getting together all over again. But then again, as you get older, it doesn't seem a gap. You didn't see them all. When you're growing up, my cousins seemed so grown up and ladylike. And then to meet them 8 years later, and you were more on an equal footing with them. But unfortunately, you know, just when I was reaching that stage with my sister, she died. But although she had emigrated to Australia, and I suppose there were more links in common with us, with things that we were doing. She had her family and I'd got married and was starting mine, and but it did seem tragic that we weren't so young. She was 32. Oh well, it happens. And well, after the war ended, it was a time of optimism, really, because the war was over. We hoped that it was, all fighting would cease. I know it was difficult, things were still rationed, but you know, with setting up our first home, there was lots and lots of plain white china, but to get something that was patterned, and it had all coming gradually, and we were when I was home, I often attended farm sales with my father or go to market, and it was at one of the farm sales that I met my husband. Well, I didn't meet him actually there. It was that they were disposing of their dairy herd, or a greater portion of it, and my father was wanting to buy some more cows for a brother who was setting up farming, and he was there at his farm sale, one of the ones of managing the cattle coming in and out of the yard. And then later, that was in the winter, and then come the spring I went to Hunt Dance, and I met him there. My brother knew him, and he asked me to attend a police ball with him at Petworth. Unfortunately, I developed a tummy bug and I couldn't go, but anyway, John decided I was worth meeting again, so we went to arranged to go with the brother to an old boys dance from connected with Plumpton Agricultural College, and then it was a question there. And when I married, I quit teaching for a while, because in those days, you know, when your family came along, you definitely didn't go on teaching or working in some cases. And then I didn't take it up teaching until my youngest son, Robin, was two, and that was a part-time one afternoon a week. Well, I did do a little bit before then. I did 6 weeks stint because the infant teacher at the another little primary school had fallen ill, and the headmistress was in dire straits about it. And my second son was 2 and a half, and every morning I would drop him at my parents' on the way to school, and he was very happy and he had a lovely day with his grandparents. But it seemed to me that he was resenting the fact that I wasn't there. He wasn't his usual loving, cuddly little self. And when I finished that little stint, it took him some time to realise that I was back home permanently. So I decided I wouldn't go back into anything permanent. I couldn't have that sort of upset in the family again. I couldn't stand it. And so later on, when the other family came in, I gradually went back into part-time teaching, and it fitted in well with farming life. When I was at school, the beginning of the autumn term, we only went half days, and the idea being that the could go out to the farms and assist in any of the crop gathering that we could, which mainly consisted of potato picking. And
could you just explain the process, Polly?
Fortunately for us, the potatoes were lifted. They either used a plough type thing or else what was called a spinner, which revolved and knocked the potatoes out of the ground without damaging them. And one followed along the rows with a bucket or basket or something, and when that was full, we emptied it into a sack and then went on, and all the potatoes were picked up. But that was only from the short time from the end of the summer holidays to about half term. But I didn't do that. My father being involved with farming, I used to catch the early bus home, which meant a walk from the other end of the village, which is about a mile from where I left my bike, and do my usual chores for him or bits round. Not that I was ever paid anything for it, but I felt that I was helping in some ways. I presume all the potatoes were safely picked up by the friends. One job I didn't like, though, was that we grew flax, and the stems of flax are extremely tough. As you know, linen must be very strong, and there was a special machine that came round and pulled it, because you use the roots as well. But before the machine could get into the field, a pathway had to be cleared all the way round, which meant you had to pull it up by hand. And oh my goodness, it was hard on the hands. But it was such a pretty picture when the flax was in bloom.
What colour?
Blue. Such a pretty shade of blue. But you see it in a lot now. There's linseed, and that is a lovely shade of blue. It doesn't last for very long before you get the green coming through. But, you know, they say that children don't know right from wrong, but I'm sure that they learn it much earlier than people intend or believe. When I was under 10, my brother said, come and look at this book. And I remember that it had a black cover and red lettering on it. It seemed very dramatic to me. And he opened it, and we were looking at scenes from the First World War. I believe the book was published by the Daily Express. And we looked through it, turning the pages and seeing the soldiers marching, the horses pulling guns, and all these things preparatory to it. And then we came to a bit, but which had been sealed, but the seal was broken, And to me, they were the most horrible pictures, really. It was all about the scenes on the battlefield. And at that time, we were living indoors, sort of an old house at Askerswell. And to go upstairs, you passed the cheese room door and then turned and went up a few more steps to get to a level to my bedroom and my parents' bedroom. And there was always such a shocking draught coming out from under the cheese room door. That was where all the cheeses were stored, on their benches, and they had to be turned upside down every day. And the candle flame would flicker like mad. My mother kept worrying. She said, come on, it's time to bed, go to bed. I'll come up and see you and tuck you in and put the candle out. And I would go up there, and trying to go past the cheese room door, and the light would flicker madly, and think, it's going to go out, I have to get undressed in the dark. And she knew I was worried about something, but I couldn't tell her because, or rather I wouldn't tell her because I knew I shouldn't have looked at that book. I told her years afterwards, but that isn't the same thing. But I was well aware that I was doing something I should not have been doing. I shouldn't even like to look at that book now. And now it seems so casual, whatever it is with television, flick, it's on, there's a man dead, or whatever. And it's no more than sweeping up flies after using fly spray, it seems. I feel that parents have less and less to do with their children's upbringing. There's too much outside influence, and oh well, the world changes, and if we're considered lagging behind if we don't keep up with it. My war started with meeting the soldiers of the Royal Horse Artillery. I suppose they must have been connected with Blandford Camp when we were at Shroton, and due to mobilisation, more soldiers being called up, they were, or perhaps it was manoeuvres even, in that first winter of the war, they were billeted out in the villages round. I finished the war with knowing lots of Canadians. And while they were over here, they had to find jobs for them to do. And when they were not on manoeuvres, because you never quite knew where they were going to pop up whenever you were in the country. And I remember my brother-in-law's embarrassment. There was a wonderful crop of dandelions, much to my father's annoyance, in one field, and mother said that to be lovely, we'll make some dandelion wine. Pauline, you can go and pick dandelions. Then my brother-in-law was on leave, and in those days, soldiers on leave wore their uniform all the time. So he said, oh, I'll come with you, me pulling a long face. And so we went off with a basket each, and we were picking dandelions, and suddenly this group of Canadian soldiers sort of emerged from the rushes and that by the river. Never saw anybody drop his basket so quickly. I mean, just imagine being a sergeant, a tough sergeant, caught holding a basket of dandelions. And we had the Pioneer Corps based near us. In all the big houses they were commandeered. I suppose they were at Knepp and at West Grinstead Park Estate and at Shermanbury, you name a big house, it had more or less been taken over for them. And they had to find occupations for them, so I understand that a lot of the present water system in our part of West Sussex was based on the work of the Pioneer Corps, which dug the trenches for the pipes. I know they dug them from Partridge Green to Ashurst. Ashurst had no piped water before then. But it always amazes me to think back, with the number of wells there must be around in the country now. There's one horrible tale about a well in a pub in Kent, and it gave way and somebody crashed down with it. Ugh. But you don't know where they are, because I know I've been living at West Grinstead for 20 years, no more than that. My youngest son wanted to have a CB radio. Well, it was difficult to get to the chimneys on the old house, so he said he'd have an aerial outside. I suppose you've put it in the garden bed just opposite your window, it'll be out of the way when it comes to mowing the grass. And he started digging, and he said, I can hear water. And there's a well just outside there. And it's been planted over, and I've planted flowers over the top, it's still there. But I'd always wondered where there was a breather pipe against the wall, and I know that before we came up there, there had been a pump on the inside of the scullery wall, and but we always thought it was connected to the well at the top of the garden. And then another well was found in the yard. There was a large slab of sandstone, I suppose it must have been 36 by 35 inches, quite that size, and a heavy lorry went over it and cracked it, and half the stone disappeared, and that was a well. And that one I think had been built to take the runoff water from the buildings. And there's another well on the farm, and that was left with a wooden well head that was padlocked, and the padlock was always being broken and opened, and it was dangerous. That was on the deepest well, and in the end the estate used iron bars or something and cemented over the top. But when they were doing building in the village and thinking of the changing what was a water mill, they were unearthing wells all over the place and asking people who lived in the village where were wells. And, when the army had manoeuvres, sometimes we saw the tranks coming out, and ultimately they were barred from doing too much damage by crashing through hedges and such things like that. And really, it seemed that they cooperated very well with the civilian life, because the iron tracks could do such damage to the roads, and of course crashing through hedges and letting cattle out. So we didn't see them very often when they were doing that, not where I lived. But of course it was exciting to see these enormous things, just the same as when a Spitfire ran out of fuel and came down in one of the fields. In that field there was a long wire stretched across on high poles precisely to prevent aeroplanes from landing. That was in case of the Germans trying to land. And this plane had run out of fuel and came along, saw our field, and landed underneath it, and the tail of the plane caught in the wire, and was very fortunate because it held it up, and otherwise it had gone into the next field and into the river. And then there was the excitement of watching the big, they called them Queen Marys, these long low loader lorries, where the wings were taken off the plane and then it was put on it. I think it went to Coulomb aerodrome, and that was a Polish squadron there, which wasn't very far from Partridge Green. So all of these things sort of made a break in our days, and excitement, a bit of gossip to talk about. Did you see? How did they do something? And the war first seemed really close when the plane crashed at Schroten. It really brought it down. You know, people were being killed, even if they were our enemies. And then again, when Sergeant Peacock was one of those that went off on the fated expedition to Norway and never returned. And then, with my brothers going so far away, when my father came up to Sussex again, I was offered the opportunity of remaining as a boarder at Shaftesbury, but because my family was so separated, I felt I didn't want to be that far away, and so I came back to Sussex with them. That was the only really major choice I made. That was my choice, because the headmistress was willing and my parents would have, but so, you know, if anything was going to happen to us, it was like the time before the war when we all had a trip in an aeroplane. It was John Cobb's Flying Circus or somebody or others. It was on a farm near us, and they, of course, the boys wanted to go, and they wanted to go up. And I was six then, and Father went to get the tickets, and how many and what age. Seven tickets, and the youngest one is six and the oldest one's 14. And you can't take them under seven. Well, said Father, you're not getting any tickets. I'm not buying any. If we don't all go, none of us will. And so I went, and I can remember, you know, the seats seemed to be slatted wooden ones. We weren't strapped in or anything, we just sat in there. And we went up and we did a big circle, and we could look out over the sea. Fortunately, in those days, I could hear above the engine, I could hear what everyone was saying, and you know, looking around, seeing everybody. Talk about children not being afraid of anything. I wasn't. I think Mother was petrified. That my brothers were hoping and hoping that they would have the lucky ticket to go up with a plane that was going to loop the loop. But alas, they didn't. As far as I was concerned, I felt very secure during the war. I had implicit trust in Mr. Churchill, and the sound of that voice on the on the radio was most reassuring. And of course the fact that I was with my parents and most of my family for the whole time, that I was never terrified or anything like that, even with the noise of planes at night. You know, when I was in bed, we never had a shelter being out in the country, and we soon learnt the sounds of the different engines. And if it was a Lancaster going out, oh, that's one of ours, and you turned over and went to sleep. At least I did. So, and I can still recognise the sounds of English planes and German planes and those noises now. I couldn't tell you or describe the noises, but now I know. But, but, you know, I suppose I was very fortunate. But the greatest thing was being kept busy. Yeah. We had so much to do. Well, everything took so much longer. It was a, You know, heating the water for this and heating the water for that. And
did you have milking machines later in the hall?
Yes, when we were at Locke. Before that, it was hand milking. So even I learned to do that. I can remember my first time of doing it. Father had a cow called Starlight, and she was a Frisian type. And I sort of sat on his knee under the cow, you know, having a, I can't get anything out, Daddy. But, you know, all the animals were friends to us. That was, you knew them all and what they did and where so-and-so was likely to be. The worst thing, though, was when they got out into the woods. And there was a lot of ramsons growing there, you know, the wild garlic, I used to call it. And they ate that. That was when we were cheese making. And I think we had the original flavoured cheese because we couldn't sell it as cheddar then. So we had garlic flavoured cheese.